to order today. It's February the 24th, and my co-chairman, Senator Wilikowski, is walking in, and Senator Huggins on my side, and then I'll go ahead and turn it over to our co-chairman on the House side.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Present today, Representative Wilson. There's a lot going on today and a lot of different things, but this is an important briefing. And I'm Representative Johnson, co-chair of Resources, and my co-chair is also on the way. So with that, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. And we're hoping the public will get a chance as this continues to play on gavel to gavel. A lot of interest in the mining industry. And it's a big, obviously, it's a part of our economy. It could be a bigger part of our economy. We want to hear what's happening out there in Alaska with respect to development and jobs. What are the challenges? And so we've, to that end, invited Steve Burrell, who's the head of the Miners Association, to come forward. And he has, delegated him the task of bringing in some of the companies around Alaska that are currently developing mining sites, and he will have them come up in order. But welcome, Steve, today. And Senator French joined us as well.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Very much appreciate the opportunity. This is, I'm going to say, the 10th or 12th year that we've done this to provide a industry briefing on the, just update you folks on the status of the industry and what's going on. You have several handouts in front of you. I'm not going to be talking towards those. Some of those you will have already seen. this afternoon, I'm going to go through some of the major mines and projects. Then Lorna Shaw is going to specifically talk about recent mine permitting experience in Alaska. And how that has worked, and then finally, we've asked Carl Hahnemann to give you folks a real brief update on the current status at Red Dog, which is serious. Major mines. There's the map showing the major projects around the state, and of course, the ones in red are the operating properties. With down in southeast. Kensington this summer should be producing gold for the first time, and it'll make six major mines within the state. From the placer mining standpoint, to start things off, 2009 and 2010, we expect to be approximately the same, with in the vicinity of 175 family mining operations around the state. Production of approximately 54,000 ounces each year. A major part of the industry spread out all over the state. Usabelli Coal Mine, the slide's a little bit difficult to read, but the current statistics at Usabelli, 130 employees, and if you looked at this first handout, you would note that when we put this, when the McDowell folks put this together, there was 125, and so they've increased that now. And this last year, 1.9 million tons per year was shipped. About 52% came to the interior power plants and the heating plants in the Fairbanks area primarily, and 48% was export coal. One of the things that Usabelli did this past year was to do a new resource evaluation, and their conclusion is that they have approximately 700 million tons within their current lease areas that they could be producing. So at their current rate of approximately 2 million tons a year, that obviously is 350 years of production. This slide, I believe we showed before, but it's extremely informative. People that are not acquainted with the mining industry, this shows the sequence of events, and of course in the center is the drag line actually doing the digging, but on the far left hand side in the cross section below, you'll see the green line representing the surface before any mining takes place. So that material is first removed, so the first block, if you will, of overburden can be removed. Below that is the first of three seams of coal that are then exposed, and they do them, of course, sequentially. The mining pit, if you will, is here in the center. And then on the right are the spoil piles, the overburden and interburden that has been put to the side, and off in the distance you see the cross section of the reclamation. And And if you look at the extension of those crossed lines up above, you can see what it actually looks like on the ground. This and over here, of course, is the final reclamation. Hecla Greens Creek Mine, 331 employees now, plus 12 full-time contractors. Approximately 79% of those are Alaska residents. Approximately 32 million annual wages plus benefits. Largest property taxpayer in the Juneau borough, Juneau area, and the largest private sector employer in all of Southeast Alaska. This picture shows the various ore body types, and the white lines are the entries, if you will, the declines that go down to access the ore in each of those ore bodies. The coloration indicates a slightly different kind of ore. And then down here, clear at the bottom, you see extension where they believe in the future they'll be able to go also. Greens Creek has now been operating since 1989, and throughout that process, they have continued to explore and find additional ore, and we believe that they're going to continue for many years to come. The ship loadout facilities for the concentrates. And next is the Pogo mine, underground gold mine. This picture was taken in the fall. You see the facilities on the ridge line there with the actual underground mine underneath this ridge. And you see that in this overlay. The different facilities we're looking towards the east across the Good Pasture River with the airstrip, of course, down to the lower left-hand corner. 2009 versus 2008, significantly improved in many ways. Safety operation, 50% reduction in reportable safety incidences. We're not saying lost time accidents, we're saying just incidences. Fewer spills, 55% reduction in reportable items. Higher production, a 12% increase to 390,000 ounces, and this is on state land. Employee retention is improved, and during the year, Teck sold their portion of ownership to Sumitomo Metal Mining, and they now have 297 employees plus 97 full-time contractors. For 2010 in the future, ongoing work to improve safety and environmental performance even further, increased to 390,000 ounces in 2010, and real challenges include fuel cost and electrical costs for the future. Other mines, two properties in Alaska that are currently in an idle status, Nixon Fork and Rock Creek. At Nixon Fork, Pacific Northwest Capital and a subsidiary, Fire River Gold, now own the property. They're working on the plan right now to decide what their future is going to look like. They're evaluating basically consolidating all the information that they've had in the past and looking at where they need to be doing additional drilling to make the most efficient startup of the property, and they expect within 2 years. Rock Creek at Nome, and if to orient you, if you have not, if you've seen the Sitnasauk Village Corporation windmills, electrical generation, it's on this ridge right here. Just off of the picture is where Sitnasauk has just installed wind generation. In the picture itself, you see the pit area off to the over here where I'm circling off to the side, and then the tailings impoundment, and then the mill facilities over here at the side. Statistics, currently 20 employees. When they're in full operation, they'll be at 135 with approximately $10.4 million payroll annually. Care and maintenance cost right now is about $17.5 million a year just for what they're doing. Water management plan being implemented, and their options are being evaluated how they expect to restart the project. Projects in advanced exploration and permitting, the most advanced is Chewett Nicole, followed also by two major projects, Donlin and Pebble. With in the case of Chewett Nicole, this is a map that you've not seen before, probably. One of the significant changes to this map is that rather than a road and conveyor that comes around to the side, there's a straight line conveyor now, an elevated conveyor opportunity that they're looking at, and then a road that better follows the topography through the area. Investment expected more than $600 million, 350 full-time jobs at the mine site, 12.5 million metric tons per year is the design capacity. The overall deposit itself, and I would point out that this mine area is just within this small piece right here, is 300 million tons of coal. If that was converted into oil, it would be the fourth largest oil deposit in Alaska. Infrastructure needs access road, elevated coal conveyor, power line, housing, airstrip, logistics center down at Ladd Landing, which is over here on the coast, a trestle out to water that will accommodate a 65-foot deep water for Cape-class vessels. Right now, a supplemental environmental impact statement is being prepared. The draft is in process. They expect to be in a public review process in the fourth quarter of this year, and expect decisions anticipated for 2011. Donlin Creek, of course, this kind of a slide with the airfield and the camper you've seen before with the ore deposits over here and over in this area. 2009, they completed the project feasibility study, conducted intensive outreach in the villages, a commitment that they had made to the people of the region. 2010, they evaluating the feedback and also looking at other options to provide energy. This project would require a very large amount of energy, and that is a major, major focus right now to figure out how to get energy to the project and have a secure and a price secure, if you will, energy scenario. Here are the villages involved. You can see they had, I think it's 11 centralized meeting locations where the different villages could come together to meet to talk about the project so their own people in the region would understand what is being proposed and what the status is right now. There have been at some points up to 300 local employees from those villages working at the site, and this year it's going to be significantly lower. And so it was an effort to brief the people and tell them, hey, here's where we are, here's what we're trying to do. So it, rather than having somebody else tell them, the company is out telling them the facts. Pebble project in 2009 and 2010, approximately the same budget at $70 million plus or minus pre-feasibility study work in 2009 and continued baseline with some exploration. And that's basically the same for this year. Continued work on the pre-feasibility and complete a pre-feasibility study. But they do not anticipate applying for permits during 2010. And in the picture, you see one of the drill rigs out on the project site. Major challenges, a source of power, of course, is going to be a huge piece. Main parts of the project would be, the road and the port and the power. We mentioned that earlier, plus the mill facility itself. Getting through the permit process, workforce development to bring the people of the region up to speed to fill those jobs wherever possible, and of course commodity prices and the overall economics, whether the project is indeed economic is not yet known, understood. This is a picture of before and after of a drill site.
As a reference point here, you can see this little portion in the upper picture, and there it is on this one. But you look out across this drill site, this was very shortly after the drill was removed. The stake, of course, shows where the actual drill hole was, and then in this side what it looks like the next year. So very rapid reclamation. Another thing, by the way, those are fins on that outhouse to keep it in line so it doesn't start spinning when it's coming back underneath the helicopter. Otherwise, it would spin and you wouldn't have anything to take home. Even human waste is taken off the site. Grassroots early stage exploration is a comparison now. In 2008, there were 30 projects that spent more than $1 million each on exploration. In 2009, that number dropped to 17 with the financial meltdown that occurred. For several companies, they were not able to get funding until late in the year, last year, 2009. My expectation is that we're going to see similar to 2008 numbers in 2010. That's extremely good news for exploration. three of the examples of three of the larger projects, International Tower Hill up at Livengood, Heatherdale Resources at Niblack, and Full Metal Minerals at Lucky Shot. At International Tower Hill, I'm showing the same data from last year, but suffice it to say that I didn't have the actual numbers to put in place here, but they're drilling from late last year and into the winter of this year, and has continued to expand and increase the grade at the property. They're better understanding the geology, and they are working very hard, very diligently. At this time, I believe they have three drills out there, drilling in those areas that are wetlands areas, so they're well frozen now, and they'll get those drilled out before breakup, and then they'll continue on later. Heatherdale Resources, project down at Niblack across from Ketchikan on South Prince of Wales. Heatherdale is the new owner. It's a combination of Heatherdale and CBR Gold, who was the previous owner, and the CBR was Committee Bay Resources Gold. And that partnership was finalized in June of 2009. And at this point, they have a 25,000-foot drilling program in process right now, $5.35 million, and they have two drills turning as we speak. Very exciting property, very exciting project for the far southeast Alaska. Full Metal Minerals. Full Metal was one of the companies that was badly damaged, if you will, by the financial downturn. And meltdown, many have called it. They expect if they indeed have their financing in place to take a 10,000 ton sample at Lucky Shot, which is of course in the Mat-Su Burrow, just up the Willow Creek. $7.5 million in that range, 25 to 40 employees. The mill for that property, incidentally, if you haven't driven through that valley, it is in place right now, and they have additional permitting to do for that, and they have other projects around the state. With that, I will turn this over to Lorna Shaw, and she will describe current permitting experiences in Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. Questions for Steve before we continue on? Senator Wagner, wanted to acknowledge just before the question goes, Senator Wagner is here, Senator Stedman is here, Senator Joe Thomas is here, and Representative Chris Tuck.
Ms. Steele, sorry I was late, but when I came in, you were talking about the Chewitna coal prospect. What is the feasibility of that being completed in the foreseeable future, put it that way?
Through the chair. Well, Senator, that project, I believe, is depending on the legal challenges against it, it is a 98% chance of becoming a mine. Again, they believe they know the feasibility of it. The work that they're putting into it right now is to get that final supplemental environmental impact statement, and they have their nose to the grindstone to get that done. They have been working incredibly hard to do that, and that property, that project has a tremendous benefit to South Central Alaska, and I think they have a very good shot at it, again, depending on legal challenges they get. There are various groups that have declared war against the coal industry. This is very, very low sulfur coal. If you're going to mine coal anywhere in the world, this is the place to do it. This is, and create jobs here.
Great. Additional questions for Steve? Thank you for your work and your presentation. We'll have Lorna Shaw now, Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers. Welcome, Lorna.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here as well, and I'm going to give an update on three other projects here in Alaska, three mines in Alaska, and I'm going to give it from a slightly different vantage, and that is looking at it from the perspective of the three most recently permitted projects. And I don't want to go over the entire permitting process. DNR has put together a fabulous presentation that does that. It's 136 slides long. I can't condense that into a slide or two, so I guess just to give you the umbrella, simply put, there's not a single permit to build a mine. There's not a single agency that blesses you to build a mine. It's not like going down to the DMV and applying for a driver's license, passing a test, and walking out and you're ready to go. It is a far more in-depth process, as it should be, but the state provides great leadership in that process. The large mine permitting team provides coordination with DEC, with the federal agencies, with all of the agencies involved in permitting a mine, and they work together to make that process as useful as possible, and they try to take an approach where you look at the mine from a whole project perspective instead of just each agency looking at their little piece of the puzzle, but to try to understand how it all fits together and how it will all work as a whole unit. So what I'd like to do is take a look at the three most recently permitted projects, which are Kensington, the Fort Knox heap leach expansion, and the Red Dog Okaluk pit expansion. First is Kensington, which is a small underground mine that's located about halfway between Juneau and Haines, and it's down here in southeast Alaska. And I don't think any discussion on mine permitting is ever complete without talking about the 20-year process that Kensington has gone through, and it has been 20 years. The Kensington and Jewellen mines were developed in the 1890s, and they operated off and on to about the 1930s. And the process for our discussion begins in 1998, about 10 years after the property was acquired by the joint venture between Coeur and Echo Bay. They went through a 6-year permitting process that finally resulted in permits, but the gold prices had dropped so low and operating costs were so high that it wasn't possible to go forward. So it's a little bit of a matter of striking while the iron is hot. Mm-hmm. So they tried again in 1998, another 3-year process, and ultimately they struck out, no permit was issued, but miners are tenacious, and in the third round of permitting, they finally received a permit in 2005. On the second page of the third round of permitting, more than 9 years into this round of permitting, and a complete U.S. Supreme Court decision later, they finally received their permits, they're in place to operate, and that was just this last June 2009. So clearly mining and permitting is not for the faint at heart. This is going to be a huge boon to the Juneau economy and a credit to all of those who came out in support of the project numerous times over the 20 years. This is a picture taken here on the Capitol steps, and Kensington does want to pass along a thank you to everybody who's been supportive throughout this entire process. But we're at a point where the project is moving forward. Huge milestone and significant congratulations to the site. They've worked 1,000 days with no lost time incidents, almost 500,000 man hours. They have additional exploration underway and a hope of a golden future. Their construction workforce is busy. I think they're going to peak at about 300 for construction, and the operations workforce is anticipated to be about 200. I think they've got about 85 to 90 employees right now, and they expect to be up to about 170 by midsummer. They expect to be in production midsummer, middle of the year in 2010. And what's really important to note on this is that the state leadership in the permitting process played a key role. The state cooperated with all of the agencies involved, with the U.S. Forest Service on the EIS, and they coordinated with the city and borough of Juneau for local permits. They brought that into their permitting process to make sure that all of the deadlines and requirements were met for permits that fell outside of DNR's boundaries. And that's the way they do business now, and that's very helpful. What's also important to note is that even though Kensington is just now completing construction, they're not even in operation yet, they are in the renewal phase for some of their permits. The permits were issued in 2005. They've been in place, and it's time to renew a number of those permits, even though they're not yet in operation. The Fort Knox heap leach project is just a new addition to an existing mine. Fort Knox is a low-grade open pit mine just 25 miles northeast of Fairbanks. And on this, thank you, Steve. On this slide, let's see, we've got the heap leach is the circle up here. You can see over here, this is the mine that they're mining in. Most of the things are marked on there, the admin facilities and the tailings impoundment down here. And then I've got it also just in drawing format to orient you. It's about a 12 square mile footprint. Down here is the Fish Creek Valley. And for those of you who were able to attend the Lunch and Learn yesterday, Bill Jeffress gave an overview of all the reclamation that's taken place in that area. And mining continues upstream in the pit area, and now there's an additional processing opportunity. And what heap leaching is, it's an alternative means of recovering gold. Fort Knox has historically been a mill and vat leaching operation, and what that means is the ore gets ground down to the consistency of about table salt, and the gold is leached out in a series of tanks. With the heap leaching option, instead of having to grind that ore down to the table salt size, they're able to just take it from the mine, place it on the heap leach, and leach the gold in place to recover it. So it's a low-cost method of recovery that allows recovery from a much, much lower grade of gold or of ore. What was once considered waste at Fort Knox can now be ore. The mill takes ore with about 0.018 to 0.025 ounces per ton of gold, and the heap leach will accept ore down to about 0.007 ounces per ton. So if you're not a miner, it looks like rock, and if you are a miner, it still looks like rock. Just to go over the timeline, because this is a new addition, well, first of all, the timeline doesn't compare to Kensington, thank goodness. The initial deposit was discovered in 1984 in an area that's been mined heavily for 100 years. The permits for the project were applied for at the end of November in 1992. State permits were received in February of 94, federal permits in March of 95, and the mine's been in operation continuously since then. The heap leach permitting process began in 2006. The state permits were issued by July, but the Federal Corps of Engineers permit wasn't issued until October 31st of 2007. And because of that delay, they lost the first season of construction on the heap leach, so the project was delayed. And most of the delays were federal, and they were simply an issue of a lack of staff resources. They had a single person working on the project. It wasn't that person's full-time job. They just simply did not have the staff to review this in the time frame that the mine had hoped for. But the state is, again, critical in permitting. DNR had the bench strength and engineering expertise to review all of the plans. And in cases where the agencies don't have that internal expertise, they have the ability and the financial mechanism to hire world-class experts to provide them oversight, review, and to verify their work to make sure that what moves forward really is in the best interest of Alaska. But the state was involved every step along the way. DEC had to approve the liners. They had to approve the liners and the installation. during the heap leach construction. And there's no rubber stamp in this process. It is a very iterative process, very collaborative, and it can be very lengthy. But permitting the heap leach ultimately leads to a longer life at Fort Knox, 2016 now for the mine and 2022 for processing. And that means a lot to Fairbanks. It means a lot to Alaska. Right now there's 500 employees, full-time employees at the mine, and with all of the construction mostly related to the heap leach, there'll be about 300 contractors on site this summer as well. Average annual wage, $70,000. These are good paying jobs. And I think more important than any of the dollar figures, Fort Knox has now passed 3 years without a lost time incident, and they are rapidly approaching 3 million man hours. Again, no lost time incident. But sometimes the money does matter. They are spending quite a bit in Alaska. About 70% of the annual operating budget is spent in Alaska. And in addition, they are the second largest property taxpayer to the borough, $2.8 million, so a significant source of local funding. Last year, $835,000 were paid in royalties to the State Mental Health Trust, almost $2 million in mining license tax, another $400,000 in annual use and claim rental fees, as well as a state corporate income tax. So these are all the benefits that it brings, and you have to be able to get through the permitting process in order to have a mine to bring these benefits to the communities.
Yes. Well, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. You just mentioned that it was the second largest taxpayer in the borough, and in the literature it says this, the largest.
And that's my mistake. They are the single largest taxpayer in the borough, single largest piece of property. I think it goes back and forth between Alyeska and Fort Knox who actually pays the most, but it's the single largest piece of property that is taxed. I think the total amount Alyeska pays slightly more.
Okay, thank you.
And then I was going to move on to Red Dog, which is in northwest Alaska. It's an open pit zinc and lead mine, and it is one of the largest zinc concentrate producers in the world. Red Dog began production in November of 1998, and it has a very complex permitting history. But they are now planning for the next 20 years of operation. After a rough year in 2008, mine production is up in 2009 to a record high, but low metals prices led to a decrease in the property tax or property the pit to the Northwest Arctic Borough. It was still $7 million, but significantly down from the previous year, but the state taxes were up. And what drives that is the zinc and lead price. There's a little bit of risk sharing in there. As the company makes more money, the state makes more money. And you can see on the slide that both zinc and lead prices were at historic lows in 2008. And thankfully, they have rebounded. And along with that rebound, the state taxes and nano royalties have come back up. So they should be up again. Good story to tell in terms of employment. 525 employees and contractors. Significant portion of those are NANA shareholder hire, 56%. About $50 million in wages and benefits. So this is a huge economic driver in the northwest portion of the state. But what they're faced with is that their current ore body will soon be depleted. And so they have been in the permitting process to expand to the pit next door, I guess is a good way to put it. And up on this slide, this area over here is what they're referring to as the Akaluk deposit, and over here is the main pit. So it really is right next door. The expansion over there, same mining equipment, same mining practices, it's just moved over a little bit. In order to permit this, a supplemental EIS was required to review the potential impacts from the mine, and again, the state's leadership was critical. The National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, requires the supplemental EIS to evaluate the direct and indirect cumulative impacts to human health specific to the project. And that's been a requirement, but there's a slightly new interpretation now which calls for a full health impact assessment, HIA, which can be very expansive. And HIAs have not traditionally been site-specific. They're more used for health statistics for a population as a whole, or, you know, general information about economic development, cultural changes, health demographics. So this was a new application. And really, the HIA, or the Health Impact Assessment, could have derailed the entire EIS process, not because of what they were expecting to be the findings, but because of the process. It's new, there weren't guidelines, it could have expanded to who knows how big, but the state's leadership was critical. They worked cooperatively with the other agencies to determine how the health information should be included. They made sure that the process didn't get out of hand. The state actually has included now on the large mine permitting team representatives from the Department of Health and Social Services to include the HIA process. So now there is a mechanism going forth. This was the first project in Alaska that included the HIA, but it probably isn't the last. So the result of the state involvement was to make sure that the information was not taken out of context, that it was appropriate and well done. Another example of what the state does is part of the Reclamation and Closure Plan. The Reclamation and Closure Plan, I'm sure you know that the state permits for closure. You have to have a closure plan in place before you'll ever get your permits to build a mine. But you know what your plan is 20 years ago probably isn't reflective of what reality is today. So that's reviewed every 5 years and then additionally as appropriate. And so Red Dog had to update their Reclamation and Closure Plan. And the state was involved, and they went through a very collaborative process that included technical review, it included community workshops, it included state expertise, and they came up with a wet closure that
Lorna,
had a wet cover.
Lorna, my apologies. It's 1 p.m. The House committee has to go in to meet. So if you want to just wrap up briefly, and then we'll...
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Basically, the bottom line is that the state's involvement in the permitting process is critical. We have a very complicated process, but it is workable, and it's directly due to the leadership that the state provides and the influence that they have to make sure that the process is done well, to protect the state's interest, but to work collaboratively to find solutions and implement the regulations.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from the committee, House members? Okay. We will go ahead and adjourn. And thank you so much for your presentation. And if it's possible for you to stay after for us to ask some more questions, that would be great. Okay, thank you. We're adjourned.
I'll do it again with you in just a second.
Actually, this is fine.
Okay. Do you want to do one more?
Test. You good?
We have a quorum to conduct business consisting of my co-chairman, Senator Wilikowski, Senator French, and Senator Wagner. Thank you all for being here. It's the 24th of February. It's 3:38-ish p.m. In the afternoon here, and we have two items on the agenda today. The first is we're going to go back and revisit our omnibus bill, that is Senate Bill 220, and we're on version K. We've got some amendments in front of members. We're going to walk through those, and then after that we're going to hear from the Alaska Railroad regarding their bonding authority and potential ability. We have asked them, they're here at my invitation, to talk about what kind of ability they might have in gas line development. Okay, so with that, we've got Mike Pulowski here. Mike, so are we on K-13? What is this up here? Which amendment do you want to do first?
Madam Chair, for the record, this is Mike Pulowski, aide to Senator Lisa McGuire. You're correct, Madam Chair. K-13 is the first one we are going to take up.
Okay.
And if I might, Madam Chair, can I ask Jay Livey from Senator Hoffman's office to come up and speak to some minor revisions that were done to the amendment since the last time it was
Absolutely.
Before the committee?
Welcome, Jay. You want to put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Jay Leiby from Senator Hoffman's office. We have the version, we should all be looking at the amendment that's the K.13 version. Okay. Just make sure. There were three.
Amendment number one. Let's label that amendment number one. So amendment number one.
Do I have a motion?
Yeah.
I would move that we adopt amendment number one. It's /K13.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion, Madam Chair.
Okay. And so there's an objection. So continue, Mr. Leiby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have three changes to present today. The first change appears in the previous section on page 3, lines 2 through 8. And in the previous section, as you will recall, when we calculated the numbers of points that an applicant would achieve through the weatherization or the heating assistance programs, we included one additional point for applying to the weatherization program. Again, from a policy perspective, we looked at that as a good way to get folks into that program. In further talks with the department, we have determined that that is a very administratively burdensome item for them. We have a variety of weatherization providers. There's no central registry of who's applied and who hasn't. And so we have, in this new version, omitted that part of the amendment.
Okay, questions for Mr. Leiby? Okay, anything further you want to add, Mike, on the...
Madam Co-Chair, just a thanks to Senator Hoffman's staff for working with the co-chair's offices to try and find a way to fit efficiency standards into this amendment, and finding out that it was too difficult to do, but it was a good effort made towards that, and so I think we'd thank them for their effort. Mm-hmm. Other than that, Madam Chair, the amendment, we've worked with them extensively on it, and I think it's a...
Senator Wilkowski.
Madam Chair, thank you. Do we is there someone from the administration here?
Is there anyone here from the administration to comment? I see HFC. Brian, did you have anything to comment?
Madam Chair, if I might, this was the Department of Health and Social Services.
Yes.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Any further discussion by the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Wilda there. I'm just wondering if the administration has a position on the amendment.
So Wilda, if you want to put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Wilda Laughlin, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Health and Social Services. This amendment is currently under consideration. We don't have a position on it. I followed Ron Creer over here, so I know he's somewhere in the building. I think he's just maybe in the wrong room.
Okay.
All right.
I'll withdraw my objection, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further objection to amendment number one? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then amendment number one passes. And that brings us then to K2. That will be amendment number two. K2, and you want to go ahead and move that, Bill?
Yes, Chairman McGuire, I would move amendment number two.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Okay, so.
And I'll just, I'll turn it over to the staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, it's Mike Pulowski for Senator McGuire. Amendment number two is 26LS1197/K2, just so everyone's on the same page. If members recall, this was the AHFC program that took the federal money and worked it into a revolving loan fund for energy efficiency. The change that was made from the governor's bill in this amendment was the inclusion of regional education attendance areas so that they could qualify to participate in the program and borrow from the revolving loan fund. We've asked Brian Butcher to be here to answer technical questions about the amendment. But if members recall, this amendment was in large part to be included in the CS in lieu of the energy efficiency grant fund that was taken out of the K version of 220 itself. Whereas originally energy efficiency was dealt through grant funds where one-time monies would be spent upgrading buildings and state public facilities, the revolving loan fund was viewed as a more sustainable mechanism where money could be loaned out, the work could be done, the energy savings would come in and refill the coffers for the next round of work. And that was the thinking behind the amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, questions? We've had previous discussion on this.
I'll just speak to the
Senator Wilkowski.
Amendment. I'm very, very pleased with this amendment. I think this is an exciting program. This is taking $18 million of the federal stimulus money that we fought for and leveraging it into $250 million. It's going to save Alaskans tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. It's going to create probably around 1,500 to 2,000 jobs. And I am very, very pleased to have this amendment in our bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I am, too. And I want to say a special thanks to Brian and Dan with AHFC for their willingness to work with us and to the administration. And it's nice to have the administration has been working with our staff throughout and making recommendations. But this was a bill they offered that they're being gracious about us including in the omnibus. And it really does add to the package. And we appreciate the cooperation that's going there, all for the same goal. So any further discussion on the part of the committee to amendment number two?
Let me get my objection out of the way, Madam Chair.
Okay, and so the objection's been withdrawn. And so hearing no further objection, then amendment number two carries. That brings us then to what will be amendment number three. That's K3. And Senator Wilkowski, you want to?
I would move amendment number three, Madam Chair.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
Okay, so Mr. Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If members will recall, this amendment was offered actually through the chairs at the request of Senator Dyson, and I believe Senator Dyson is here. And this was the study of compressed natural gases in transportation vehicles, as the members heard recently.
That's great.
And I'd ask if he had any interest in speaking, perhaps.
Senator Dyson, yeah, come forward. While he's coming up, I'll tell you, I was just talking with somebody in Vancouver yesterday that is in negotiations with the borough in Barrow, the North Slope borough, looking at setting up a compressed natural gas station there. And they're looking at moving their fleet to compressed natural gas. So there are communities already taking a hold. So it's interesting. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thanks to the committee and you for hearing it also. I might mention this gentleman has been very helpful to us and also Michelle. And we appreciate that. We could have lined up, you know, several experts from around the country who are making this work very well in their jurisdictions, and we didn't. I assumed that you folks would agree to this, and so it didn't do that. And we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions, Senator Wilkowski?
I think this is a great amendment. I think particularly as we move forward and we see that we're probably going to be reaching points in the next decade where we have oil to gas ratios of 15 or 20 to 1, meaning the price of oil to gas, it makes all the sense in the world in terms of cost savings and also environmental savings, and also with the huge amount of natural gas we have in Alaska, to start moving the state in the direction of powering vehicles with natural gas. And so I think this is a great step forward.
And I might add, in almost in the jurisdiction that overlaps between you and I, there we have the landfill where the gas that's coming off the landfill is kind of a problem. And right there at Merrill Field, similarly, there's enough gas coming off of the regional landfill to power all of the government vehicles in state and local in the Anchorage Bowl area nearly for free. And the environmental folks always like it. And as I pushed at this, Most of the resistance I've had as I've worked on this the last two or three years is just kind of bureaucratic inertia, you know. And indeed, what we will do here is get past the sticking point of getting some high compression filling stations that can fill a vehicle up quickly, and just tip things that are kind of high centered. And I appreciate your support.
That's excellent. Yep, industrial or state government industrial anchors are always important in these projects. So, thank you very much, Senator Dyson. And with that, is there?
I'll renew my objection, Madam Chair.
Okay. And so, seeing and hearing no further objection, then Amendment Number 3 carries.
Thank you.
That brings us to Amendment Number 4, which is K6, and this is by Senator Wagner.
I withdrew that the other day, Madam Chair.
Oh, you did?
Okay. Yeah, I did.
Oh, that's too bad.
Well, there was some fear about the cost of distribution and collection out in the rural areas, and okay. We want to look at that, and we can do something next year, maybe.
Okay.
And there's a couple other programs around that. Golden Valley has a program, and we want to look at it and see if we want to duplicate it for the other electric utilities. So,
okay,
maybe make something better of it.
Fair enough. Well, let's keep it in our sights anyway. So then, Amendment Number 4 will be K11, and it's by me. So I'll go ahead and move that amendment. Amendment Number 4.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
Okay, Mr. Pulaski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, members' amendments on line 19 and line 22 should have, on line 19 and appropriated to the fund, crossed out. Mm-hmm. Just want to make sure we're all on the same amendment, Madam Chair. This
and 22.
And 22. This amendment repeals and replaces sections 20 through, I believe, 23 of the K version of SB 220. This was the resurrection of that alternative energy loan fund. And this was an old program through the Department of Commerce that provided small loans to residences and businesses that allowed for conservation programs. If you recall from the previous testimony, this program actually returned money to the state in the long term, and the money was appropriated out of what was a successful program. And so they've lain dormant on the statute books. The idea was to resurrect that program and extend it perhaps to more commercial entities. However, when this amendment was brought up in the last committee, we had just recently learned from the Department of Commerce that the federal laws relating to how mortgage lenders were governed changed July 1. And so really got in the way of trying to do something for homeowners in the section. So the K11 amendment that we took up last time is only for commercial alternative energy conservation loans. I think the important points are page 1, line 19, page 22. That language was crossed out at the direction of the department, specifically because the intent was to be a revolving loan fund, similar to the AHFC fund, and if this created problems in the way the money would revolve through the fund. Madam Chair, I think the other final important point was brought up in the last committee, and that was section 21, page 2, lines 22 through 28. And this is the turndown provision as you cross that $30,000 threshold to the $50,000 threshold. This is to work with the private sector in terms of loans from commercial banks, so that once you start to pass that $30,000 threshold, they found that then you need to be working in conjunction with sort of the actual marketplace of traditional public banks. So. Madam Chair, that's really the amendment. This allows businesses to borrow from the state, usually when they don't have access to other financing, and do small projects to provide efficiency. And I think it fills an important hole within the omnibus as a whole to get to the commercial side.
Absolutely. And we've heard from many Alaskans, particularly small business owners, that have come into our office and certainly throughout the year asking for this kind of a provision. And I do think it fills that hole. We've got public buildings, certainly. We've got our residences. But you know, the hope too is that it private small businesses, that anything that's not a part of that overhead will ultimately lead to more competitive service pricing and goods pricing, and that's, you know, you can't mandate it, but that's what you hope for. So,
and if I may, Madam Chair, thanks to Greg Winiger, who ably presented this amendment at the last committee hearing, and for the Department of Commerce for working closely with our office on drafting this amendment.
Thank you very much. Very much a team effort.
And actually, Madam Chair, yes. I might thank one more. This actually started off as an idea from Senator Egan's office,
right,
that we work closely with their staff to integrate their concepts into this bill as well.
We're just racking up the votes. But he's got to have a little stake in it. That's the key. So,
Senator, Madam Chair, I'll withdraw my objection to the amendment.
Thank you, Senator French. Okay, and so seeing and hearing no further objection to amendment number 4, that carries. That brings us then to Huggins' amendment. We'll go ahead and just offer it on behalf of him, because we'll label this amendment number 5. This is K.10. We were looking at doing this in my office anyway, in conjunction with the House. So we'll go ahead. I'll go ahead and offer this as a McGuire amendment, and then there's an objection for discussion.
I'll do that.
Okay, and Senator Wilikowski, you wanted to. We all know what the amendment does. We all understand.
Madam Chair, I wasn't here, so maybe okay. You just give me a 1 minute.
And that'd be great. And Fish can walk through the details, but fundamentally the notion is that nuclear is a type of energy production that may be beneficial to Alaska. It may be the kind of thing that solves problems, particularly in rural Alaska, and we wanted to have an amendment addressing it. In my original bill, some of the original legislation I dropped, we left it out because, for obvious reasons, there's debate about it. But I'll let Fish go ahead and give the detail of it, and then Senator Wilikowski's got an amendment he'd like to make.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Mike Pulaski, aide to Senator McGuire. We do have Sharon Long from Senator Huggins' office here, who presented this at the last meeting. And I'm happy to walk through as well, but if she would like to come up, that's fine. Oh, that's fine. Madam Chair, Section 4 provides conforming language to include special nuclear material facility, kind of grabbing the universe of facilities. This is page 1, line 1617. The universe of facilities that exist into the express provision in our law that says you have to go to NERC. So if you wanted to do one of these facilities, the law was silent on it. Now it's explicit that if you wanted to do this, you have to go before the Nuclear Energy Regulatory Commission.
Huggins is here.
Section 5, if I recall, was more conforming language with including that new form of facility that I believe federal statute has gotten towards. Section 6 was an interesting step. There's some case law out there that is questionable on how the state can deal with regulating through health and safety on the nuclear waste disposal facilities, but we do have the ability, we heard from drafting, to regulate on the economic side. So Section 6 gives the state and the legislature the ability of regulating the economics of nuclear energy. Section 7 does change existing statute to repeal the governor from issuing a permit for nuclear facility within the state. Under this bill, it would be NERC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and then the municipality with jurisdiction would allow to overrule the siting of a facility. Section 15 is a revision in the power project loan statutes, so the power project fund within AEA, allowing nuclear projects to qualify. Right now, they can't. Yep. This would just allow them, not forcing them to be, but allow the department to consider them. Section 22 is in the definition of alternative energy as it relates to the consideration of financing for energy improvements. So when banks are financing energy improvements, they have to look at alternative energy life cycle costs. Current law would not allow nuclear to be considered in that. So this would actually include nuclear now. So if the state was building a school in Galena, and Galena had a small nuclear reactor, the state would be, in consideration of what the long-term life cycle costs of that energy system were. Right now, if that situation existed, in financing the school or the public building, the state couldn't consider the existence of that nuclear energy because it was expressly prohibited in statute from doing that. Section 27, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I misspoke. I believe Section 27 is what I was just referring to. Section 22 was the Power Project Fund information. Importantly, Madam Chair, on section, on page 4, lines 9 through 11, these should be crossed out in members' amendments.
Yep.
And this came up at the last hearing on this amendment, that we were repealing the prohibition against the transportation of nuclear material in statute. That, when we did further research, was not necessary because the prohibition was on the transport of hazard high-level nuclear waste material except for the purposes of disposal out of state. And so the existing prohibition made sense, and so rather than repealing that prohibition by crossing out the language on 9 through 11, we leave that existing prohibition in place that you cannot transport high-level nuclear waste material in the state except to dispose of it out of state. Yeah. Madam Chair, I'd apologize to Senator Huggins and his staff if I butchered his amendment to this bill, but...
Senator Huggins has arrived just in time before we made any kind of a mess. So we're on Amendment 5, and I put my name on it. We should make it a Huggins amendment. Just add it or put it before, however you want to do it.
Yeah, I'm not. You can leave it. That's fine. That's fine.
Okay. So, Senator Huggins, did you want to add anything to the discussion?
No, I guess there. I guess, Madam Chair, there have been some discussion about the approval authority, and as I understand it, the attempt that we're making here is to sort of depoliticize that, and I don't think the governor has some admission. Maybe the governor should be the approval authority, and as I recall, I don't think the governor really has approval authority on other energy projects, but help me out on that.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, except in my understanding, in terms of the capacity of a line item veto, if the state was funding projects, then the governor would certainly have a say in the project. But I'm not aware of other authorities. We might have Brian Kane online. I'm not sure if he is. But
let's see here. Brian, are you out there? I don't see you, but no.
That was, Madam Chair. Also, I think it's important to recognize Senator Huggins through the chair that the governor being the head of state in the Department of Environmental Conservation is tasked with permitting. The relationship between the department and the governor is fairly direct.
Exactly. You know. Exactly. So, I mean, the governor has a control factor, he's just not the final approving authority. So I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. So, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I applaud your effort and Senator Huggins' effort bringing this forward. I think we did hear a lot when we traveled the state and in public testimony and in our hearings that people wanted the option, the opportunity to discuss and propose nuclear in Alaska, and I think it's time that we have that discussion. I guess just one slight philosophical difference is on that approval issue. I do think this is a somewhat of a major policy shift in moving towards nuclear, and I personally would feel more comfortable having the governor have that final say, and only because when you give it to one department, Department of Environmental Conservation, they're looking at DEC issues, whereas the governor, I think, would bring in public safety, for instance, to verify that. That this couldn't be accessed by trespassers, he would bring in, or she would bring in, health and social services to commissioners and staff to assess whether or not this was a public health issue. Bring in other departments, possibly fish and game, to determine whether or not there were fish and game issues. So, I guess that's the only place that I would. Take a slight issue would be that Section 7, which takes out the authority of the governor to basically approve the permit, and so that would be the one change that I would propose we make. And I certainly understand your rationale, and it's just a philosophical difference, and happy to live with whatever the body decides.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I guess I would hope any project, I mean, the governor has a chief of staff and the commissioners, and I would hope that they staff all projects, not just nuclear projects, with those considerations and balances. I mean, I don't think this changes that, because the chief of staff has all those agencies that are working through him to the governor. So I happen to agree with what you're saying, but having the governor is the stamp factor, I don't think really changes that one way or the other, because I think it's mandatory to happen on any project.
I don't know if we have people from the administration here who have an opinion on this or not. I see Mr. Swenson and Mr. former Senator Terrio.
You're walking in.
Just walked
to
in.
The gauntlet. Welcome. See what happens when you show up. So we're on the nuclear amendment. We're Senator Terrio, I don't know if, why don't we take a brief at ease?
Chairman Gene Terrio for the administration. I've had a little bit of discussion with staff, your staff, and Senator Wilikowski's on the amendment. I'm sorry, with Senator Wilikowski's, and I spoke to Senator Huggins' staff just briefly before the hearing. I guess the one thing, just it's a policy call for you to make, is right now, if the requirement is that the administration, the governor, make the decision, all the agencies are below him, and so he would be soliciting information out of the agencies where it might be applicable. If you put the responsibility into one of the agencies, is there a guarantee that that agency will reach across to another and bring information in? And I guess there has been an email back that I haven't seen from the geologic folks who say, well, there could be some earthquake issues or seismic issues that we might want to just make a statement on. Now, in conversation with Senator Huggins' staff, it may be that the federal process, you know, reviews all of that adequately. That's something that I've not had a chance to look at. Perhaps, you know, the Senator Huggins' staff or your staff has looked at that and feel comfortable in advising that it's more than taken care of in that venue. So that's the one concern, is, you know, many times if the responsibility is given to an agency, there will be some language, either regulation or statute, that says, you know, they'll render a decision in consultation with another agency. And whether you do that in statute or in regulation, that's the chance that you might be losing some valuable information into the decision that's to be made.
Mm-hmm. And if I may, Madam Chair, for the record, this is Mike Pawlowski. To clarify, page 2, lines 17 through 18, it's directing the department to adopt regulations, and that is very broad in this amendment. The Department of Environmental Conservation shall adopt regulations to govern the universe of options to them in granting permits to this. It is very loose language, Madam Chair.
And can you comment on the federal regulations?
Madam Chair, I'd not feel comfortable.
Would you feel comfortable commenting? Sharon could come forward. I think that's important. And then just one thought out there that circulates in my mind. The governor's position is a political position. And, you know, historically we try to think of our departments as more or less non-political. That doesn't always work out. But the one concern I would have would be that if you had a governor that had a particular opinion about nuclear, that could somehow infiltrate the decision-making process and sort of be that preventative first step to getting to the next level. But Sharon?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and co-chair and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Long. I'm staff to Senator Charlie Huggins. I have not read all the federal regulations. However, I have spoken with a fellow who took a nuclear project farther than any other nuclear project has gone in this state. And the NERC, the Nuclear Energy Regulatory Commission, has control over all health and safety issues. They are the ones in control of the seismic, the geologic, the air, the water, all the health and safety issues. And we, according to our legal advisors in the Terry Miller Building, have can legislate only as to economic decisions with a nuclear project. In referencing what Mr. Pulaski said, it looks like in this legislation, it's wide open for our state to adopt regs requiring whatever level of scrutiny from whichever departments they may think are necessary to look at it. So we don't have any regulations on the books now in Alaska. There are 31 other states that do have commercial nuclear industry, and I would assume we wouldn't be reinventing the wheel. We would look to our brother and sister states to see how they've done it.
Senator Huggins.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, number one, the fact that we're getting this, on the books is important, just for the nukes. And, you know, I would prefer we not belabor the approval-disapproval part. But I happen to agree with you on the political piece of it. But, you know, I guess politics plays in about everything we do around here. So, you know, I don't think it's that huge a deal. But I'm firmly convinced, no matter who is governor or commissioners, that the NERC will be in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. And we will just be kind of saying, yep, you can put it over there on the corner by the green tree kind of piece, because the rest of it will be totally supervised.
Absolutely.
And rightfully so.
Senator Wilkowski, thoughts?
Yeah.
You haven't officially proposed anything. We're having a discussion.
Right. And again, I appreciate Senator Huggins for bringing this forward. I think this is an important amendment. I think this moves us forward in this into the nuclear age. My only concern, and I don't know enough about nuclear to say whether how they regulate is good or bad. But I would just I would just be concerned about taking away that process, that additional layer of protection. We all know what can go wrong when nuclear goes wrong, and it's big. And so I guess from my perspective, we agree on 99% of the amendment. I just, that tiny little portion, I personally would feel more comfortable with having the governor ultimately approving the permit.
Depending on who's governor at the time.
Well, ultimately you're right. It's, you know, I guess you can't escape politics in this, but I do think that having the governor ultimately make the decision, he's elected by all the people of Alaska, I think the governor would necessarily be more likely to involve other departments and divisions, and I think you do get an additional level of protection for the public there. So I guess that's what I would advocate for is that. And it looks to me, just in looking at the statute here, that if we removed Section 7 on page 2, lines 16 through 20, then that would alleviate the concerns that I had. Because there currently is language that, if you look, that language is in the bill already. The Department of Environmental Conservation shall adopt regulations governing the issuing of permits required by of this section. However, a permit may not be issued until the municipality with jurisdiction over the proposed facility site has approved the permit. That's already in the statute. The thing that it's removing is Section 4 of the statute, which says the governor has approved the permit. And so by removing Section 7 of this amendment, you would essentially leave this language in there, but you would add back that the governor has approved the permit. So I guess that's what I would suggest, Madam Chair.
So your amendment to amendment number 5 would be to remove any reference to Section 7.
You would remove Section 7, page 2, lines 16 through 20.
So the amendment to the amendment's been offered. Senator Huggins, is that deemed friendly, or do you want to object?
Yeah, I object. I mean, I think we're kind of pole vaulting over. So, I mean, I just assume go ahead and call the vote and let's do it.
Okay. So let's go ahead and call the vote on amendment to the amendment number 5.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stedman? Senator Stevens? Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yes.
Senator McGuire?
This is very unusual, but I'm going to ask to take a brief at ease. Back on the record, and my vote is no. Okay, and so the amendment to the amendment number 5 has failed to pass at this time, and conversations will continue on the subject. But again, the amendment as a whole now sits before us unamended. Any further discussion?
I'll remove my objection to it, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further objection? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, Amendment number 5 carries. Now, we've got this last amendment here. Or do we?
Madam Chair, for the record, this is Mike Pawlowski. You should have a simple amendment number.
Amendment number 6, guys, is just that single sheet of paper, page 2, line 24. Following, including insert nuclear. Senator Huggins, this is your amendment. You want to move the amendment?
Yeah, I move the amendment stated.
Okay, is there an objection? Actually, no objection. We can all get that. This is the kind of amendment we can swallow right away. Yeah. This is about what you get. For those out there, we can do this. This is where we sit. So hearing and seeing none, no objection, then amendment number 6 carries. That brings the bill back before us. Let's have a vote. Oh, no. It's still got work to do. So Senate Bill 220 continues its journey, and now we have 6 amendments embedded into that document. Invite members to continue on. We've got next week is Energy Council, but the week after that, Senator Lukowski and I want to get this bill out of this committee and onto the Senate Finance Committee. So just kind of keeping in mind that you've got this next week. And for those in the public listening and those here in the audience that have participated that, you know, really synthesized down, and if there are further amendments, we're willing to take them. We are working on a couple more ourselves, so 220 is still open. Okay, and with that, we'll set aside the bill, and we will then bring up the Alaska Railroad. We have General Gamble here and his team. So bring your team up, General. This is really important. You'll understand. Yeah, distribute. Welcome to Senate Resources, and we have you, and thank you so much for being patient. We wanted to get those amendments out of the way. So we have you on the agenda today. You've been invited here at my request to give an overview of Alaska Railroad's bonding authority and potential role in gas line development. And so just for a brief minute, if I can, for the committee's edification, for those that don't know, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Huggins do know, but haven't had those conversations yet with Senator Wagner or French. Prior to the start of session, we had a retreat, a Senate retreat. We had some discussion about the role of in-state gas more broadly, and Senator Huggins and I came away after that discussion, and we both had different ideas, and we came to this agreement, let's have an in-state gas caucus to find a place in the legislature where we can talk about the issue of in-state gas, not the monetary part or return to the treasury of a broader, bigger line, but really just in-state gas, both commercial and residential use. Felt that was important. We then started the caucus, brought on 17 members, both the House and Senate. It is a nonpartisan caucus. Everybody has a different kind of viewpoint in that caucus about why they come to the caucus, but the overall mission is to try to get, as soon as possible, natural gas into the hands of Alaskans, both for residential purposes and commercial purposes. That caucus continued on in dialogue and discussion about 2.5-3 weeks ago. Senator Huggins, myself, Representative Ramirez and Representative Johnson were in a kind of a little meeting discussing things, and we decided, you know, who are the people out there that could do this? And again, with respect to Mr. Swenson, who's in the room, and others who may have had a role in in-state gas line considerations in the past, the thinking was that we wanted to get a new, fresh set of eyes on this project, and that the work that Harry Noah had done was ready to go. There were parts of it that needed continued work, but that we felt Department of Natural Resources really is bogged down. There's a lot they're working on with the GIA. They're continue on in that mission, and frankly, in a way, maybe have a conflict of interest before them in trying to think about in-state gas uses. We did put the 500 MCF limit, but nevertheless, there was that feeling. So it was a collective agreement in that group that we came up in our group with just at that moment two different entities. The first was the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. This committee has seen them in action with respect to their competence in bonding. Frankly, you know, small state, who can do the bonding? We've seen their work in the weatherization program and other things. Talked to them. The other was the Alaska Railroad. And really, when we kind of fine-tuned it down, the thinking was the Alaska Railroad. Went back and looked at the statutes, and everybody should have a copy here. 4240560 specifically pertains to North Slope Natural Gas Pipeline, and this was embedded in our statutes already, that the corporation may provide, this is under the Railroad Corporation statutes, corporation may provide financing for the acquisition, construction, improvement, maintenance, equipping and operation of a natural gas pipeline and related facilities for the transportation of natural gas recovered from the North Slope of this state without regard to whether the facilities are or will be owned in whole or in part by the corporation or located on land owned by the corporation. Below it, you see a broader reference to the Kenai Gasification Project. The point was that most specifically the Alaska Railroad, under its section of Alaska law, has already been referenced with respect to a natural gas pipeline and other economic development opportunities in the state. So we met, again, at our request, not at the railroad's request, with General Gamble and his staff. We talked with them about some of the unique bonding authority that they had. We talked about some of the, what's their day-to-day operations, what are the kinds of things that they are expertise in. So I've asked them to come. We have asked them to come here today to talk a little bit about that. They are a non-political entity. They take no position on the bill that is before you, which will be heard later in this committee, Senate Bill number 287. My bill that would task them with this, but really today they're here at our invitation to answer questions and give background on the record as to what it is that they do day in and day out that that would allow for the expertise that the legislature may be asking them to provide in the form of a bill. So with that, welcome to the committee, General Gamble.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Co-chairman and members, for the record, my name is Pat Gamble, President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation.
And I'm Bill O'Leary, Chief Financial Officer for the Railroad.
This this is quite an interesting topic. I like to say that we just like to move stuff, and this is a little bit more than that. And so what I always do when presented with something that looks complicated is go back to the simple things and review the mission statement. And what I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about what we do bring to the table with regard to our capabilities, and then we can talk in more detail about, on the financing side, if you want to get into the bonding, the railroad's unique capabilities in that area too. So I'll just summarize a little bit about the Alaska Railroad. In the legislative intent language of the Corporate Act that created the railroad, there were four items mentioned in the mission statement. One of the four was transportation. Three of the four was economic development for the state of Alaska. The railroad obviously came a long time before the Department of Transportation, and we've actually grown up as two separate entities, where in other states the railroad, if there was a regional state railroad, would normally work for the Department of Transportation. And in that lifespan of somewhat independent railroading in the state of Alaska, we have created quite a a methodology for dealing with railroad projects and independently dealing with them, so that I and my staff personally get involved in going out to the communities and sitting down in community assemblies and council meetings and talking about railroad projects as opposed to having it done by the department. That cuts two ways. One is trying to work with cities through whom the rail line goes, or proposed rail extensions or spurs might go. And then we've also developed the ability in-house to do projects that, frankly, are getting larger and larger. Now, it's a point of pride, and I will mention this to my staff, as as your confidence in the railroad to even have us here in the first place to address a project of this stature in the state, and it says something about the track record and where you hold us, and that level of confidence and trust is very greatly appreciated. What have we done along the way that may have built some of that confidence and trust? Well, we deal in things like export coal. We deal with foreign customers, marketing out of state, internationally. We have worked very hard to increase our passenger service, and of course that's mostly out of state, but the in-state passenger service attempt to move ourselves toward commuter rail and becoming more transportation rather than recreation oriented, a balance between the two. Right now it's certainly recreation oriented, but the growth is clearly in the direction along with Alaska's growth. And so once again, I guess what I'm leading to is as we sit down and talk with community plans, we deal with larger and larger projects such as the bypass in Fairbanks, but we get down into the individual projects that are very important to smaller communities like Talkeetna, because they have some real issues there that are just as important as the big issues in Fairbanks to the citizens. And so we are independently working each one of these issues as we go along, and we've gotten used to how that process goes. We've gotten used to going after federal money, to advocating for certain kinds of dollars for certain kinds of projects, for permitting, licensing, figuring out how to fit ourselves into certain federal pots of money, and so on and so forth. I guess the Railroad Corporate Act set the railroad up in 1985 to be able to do these things, but we've only recently, I would say, in probably the last 10 or 12 years, really started doing these things. And now you talk about entering the railroad into a project of significant magnitude. And in fact, on the financing side, the Corporate Act foresaw the development of the state of Alaska, the economic development intent of the Corporate Act, and set the railroad up with certain powers alongside its independency that allows the state, you all and others, to come to us and use us as a tool for economic development on a macro scale, not a micro scale. And clearly that's what we're about discussing here today. Now, I think the intent in those days was mostly focused on the financing side, because as we look at one of the pieces of legislation that you referenced before, and that was funding the gas pipeline, the big gas pipeline, that was under the Knowles administration and was to the tune of about $17 billion. And we had certain powers to be able to do that, which the state had never taken advantage of before. The Agrium, we came before this body before in Juneau and talked about getting pre-approval for $2.9 billion project for Agrium. So over time, there's been a growing recognition, that the railroad actually can make a significant contribution to large-scale economic development in the state of Alaska. I'm here to say that we very much have those powers, and Bill can talk about that. Along with AHFC, we have some things that actually they don't. And I would assume that in the discussion of the kind of thing you're looking at, we would sit down and we would look at both of those and determine what's in the best interests of the state, and we're ready to do that. And that's why I brought Bill here along today, in case you have some specific questions about what are the differences that we might be talking about. The railroad corporation right now, the next thing I would say is, well, what kind of shape is the corporation in to sit down and and even be counted among the possible players for a role like the one that you have designated. We're very much a piece of litmus paper with regard to the economy of the state of Alaska. We're hunkered down right now, is the way I put it, and probably will be for the next 2 years at least, until we see the recovery that's starting to show up across the country really show up here in Alaska, and we get kind of back to normal, if there is such a thing. But in the meantime, we've cut back. We've reduced the size of the railroad by somewhere between 20% and 25%. The management team has been cut back. We've had hiring freezes. We've got pay freezes on the management side. I mean, we've done a lot of things that you only do in tough times. We've managed to preserve the bottom line reasonably well. As we come out of 2009, we've kept our capital program reasonably healthy. We're not deferring huge amounts of maintenance and worrying about things falling apart. We've made a safer rail line, and we're able to ride this period out in pretty good shape. So corporately, I think you're talking about a company that's in reasonably good shape, and I know that would be on your minds as you looked at the entity that would take over a large project like this. But It is not a robust corporation right now by any means, and that management cutback, of course, is one of the things that you would be concerned about in terms of how we would go forward with something like you're proposing. In the meantime, we are going ahead with several large projects, and we are a contractor to a project over at Port McKenzie that's in the neighborhood of $300 million. We're looking at a project in Fairbanks that all told could run somewhere near that amount. And we're continuing to build our rail line between Anchorage and Fairbanks, which we did bond for, and that's $165 million worth of debt, and that we're 4 years into a six-year project, and we're on time and on money on that one. So that's good news. All that said, I will leave you really with that overview, and we'll be happy to answer the questions in the direction that you want to take them. With respect to one of the questions we often get, well, how many times have you been out in the public to sell debt? And on the books right now, there were five times that we've done that over the life of the railroad. Four of those have no expiration date. They're still on the books. One of them, which was the Agrium project, the Agrium Kenai gasification project, that legislation terminates in June of 2015. The associated Port McKenzie project piece that was tacked onto that, which was the $300 million that was tacked onto that pre-approval, that actually has a sundown date of 2012. So they're a little bit different. But nevertheless, those are the only two that that will close out eventually. The rest of them are on the books and still there. I think with that, Madam Chair, with that discussion about our role in economic development and taking on a larger role, with that as a base and a background, I'll leave it to your questions.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that this issue has come up before, the idea of having the railroad do a bullet line or a gas pipeline. Why hasn't it ever happened in the past? I mean, is there?
The only time it's formally come up was when Governor Knowles announced the financing of the gas pipeline, the big gas pipeline. His idea was to use the railroad financing capability, the tax-free capability with certain special features, in order to move something forward, because the financing was under discussion. It was a big number. How are we going to do this? And so the idea was, well, the railroad has a nice way of meeting that financing capability. That kind of flared and died. And since that time, we have had no other overtures of any even semi-formal type along those lines.
Senator Wilkowski.
And I've also heard that there are some potential IRS issues. Has the IRS said you can do this? Are you aware of any of those issues?
The IRS issues are definitely an issue. We would have to get a letter of ruling from the IRS, and I would be happy to let Bill O'Leary explain that in more detail if you'd like to go into that.
I'd just be curious what the issue is and what the prospects are for actually getting permission from the IRS to do this.
Excellent. And Bill, on that too, if you can, you know, even more broadly talk about the bonding authority itself so that the committee understands, for those that don't know what it is, how it came about, and then segueing into what the challenges would be to use it, et cetera.
Certainly. When the railroad was transferred from the federal government, in the Federal Transfer Act, there was a provision put into the act that effectively, we believe, removes the railroad from many of the IRS rules related to tax-exempt bonds. And one of the biggest issues with tax-exempt debt is, in most situations, you can't use it for the benefit of private entities. It normally has to be used for governmental purposes, normally by a governmental entity. Now, there are a number of things out there about volume cap and things like that, where you can use it for smaller dollars. But the provision in the transfer language appears to make the railroad outside of that. Those particular rules, and therefore the railroad could issue debt in an unlimited quantity to support private activity, and which again is a very unique provision. It's, to our understanding, we're the only entity in the United States that actually has that particular provision. So that is in the transfer language. We have had a number of different law firms, including the legislature, actually had a firm back in 2002 review this. And each one of them has come back in varying degrees, but of agreeing that there is this ability, that the railroad does have this ability, but almost everyone has come back and said, but to do this, you will need to go through the private letter ruling process with the Internal Revenue. And that is our understanding is a very project-specific process, and it's not something we can just go to IRS and say, hey, we want to go do a project. We don't know what the project is. Do we have this ability? They would actually need to, you'd need to be further along in the project to have a specific project that you would need to bring to them and a plan of finance. So we have, as Pat mentioned, have a number of authorizations on the books. Before the railroad can issue any public debt, it does require legislative approval, both whether for our purposes, internal railroad purposes, or for these larger, more economic development type activities. Bond Council has also given us their opinion that any use of the railroad, these abilities, would need to have substantial railroad involvement, sort of a nexus of the railroad and the project. So in the case of the Agrium project, as an example, that particular project would have been significant financial benefit to the railroad. We'd be hauling a lot of coal. We were, looking at different ownership structures and things of that nature that would have given us that nexus. So making, as I do sometimes, a long story interminable here, we need to go through the IRS private letter ruling process.
Absolutely. Okay, any further questions on that subject? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, if there are no other questions, I don't want to dominate the time, but I didn't see hands raised. So if this project were to cost, say, $5 billion, and you were to go out and bond for that, what kind of interest rate would you be looking at? What would be the annual payment that would be associated roughly out of the general fund to pay for that? Can you give us some sort of sense of what kind of financials we're looking at?
Actually, no. I couldn't without having an understanding of any one of a number of different issues as to who's the actual owner going to be of it, what's the term of the debt, what is the security behind the debt. That's really going to be determining if the state were the security behind the debt. We could certainly generate those numbers based on what the state's credit rating is at this particular point. But if it was another entity, a private entity that actually owned the facility or was responsible for making the debt payments, it would be more related to their particular credit.
Absolutely.
So, and just to follow up to that, so you could actually bond for a private entity, let's say NSTAR wanted to build this. You could actually go out, put a bond out, and then NSTAR would take advantage of that extremely low rate
and then they would go ahead, build the line, and then pay the railroad that extremely low rate. And so really there'd be nothing coming out of the general fund, I guess, in that case, or very little.
Certainly, Senator, that's one possibility. That's one model.
We would, through the chair, we would be a conduit financier, no recourse to the railroad, no recourse to the state, and I would assume that that's probably the model that we would be most interested in from all parties looking at the financing. And that's certainly the way we've looked at some of these in the past is because, I mean, if we went out the little railroad that we are and tried to go on the market, I mean, I don't think that would work very well. But if we had somebody big behind us backing us up, then we would administer for the life of the bonds, we would be the administering function. And if there were any reissuances in the future or whatever, we would stay through the life of those bonds as the administrator. The railroad would take a fee for that, a small fee, and it's a common fee that's out in the financial world. It's a way to make some money for the railroad as well. But certainly the recourse would not come to the railroad, and probably the state would not want the recourse to come to the state, I would assume.
Senator Wagner.
Yeah. This is getting awful close to talking about the railroad finance and a mega project. So let's talk about the complexity of what that would entail. What do you see as the complexity in that? As far as presentation of the project to the financiers and what you're going to be required to have available when you go after that finance.
Senator, you're talking to a former military guy, and I pardon the bias, but the bigger and more complex a project, the more responsibility and authority that the leadership of the project has to have to make it go forward. If it gets diluted, if it gets watered down and spread out, the project will consume itself with the generation of energy in a whole bunch of different loops everywhere. That's at the same time one of the things that causes a lot of difficulty in large business deals, but it's also the strength of some companies is the fact that their reputation for getting things done depended on them to be pretty darn authoritative about the way it's done and pretty strong in the way they move forward to get it done. Small project, you can get away with a lot of different ways to get it done, but the bigger the project, I think the project leadership is going to be absolutely important, and then the project leadership has got to have support. There can't be insurgencies going all around in the background trying to take the project apart while the project is trying to go forward. In my view, that is the number one threat to a large project. Beyond that, you know, if you're an engineer, you just build stuff. It just gets bigger. You just build bigger. That isn't the complexity is the size of the project. The complexity happens to be in these other areas where the real support and the authority and responsibility have to go together and be linked at the top, and then support that and let them get the job done.
Senator Wagner?
I don't want to get into a long discussion on it, but that's not what I've been told by people that really do mega projects. I mean, it's a lot more complex and complicated than that. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I almost want to stand up and cheer after hearing that, because that's exactly why we approached the railroad, was because, I mean, number one, several weeks ago you used the term you can hunker down, and you just reminded us of that, and there's too much capability both institutionally and individual members and a staffing process, because my experience with the railroad comes here with a package that everybody understands, it's complete, and it gives both sides of the conversation about the advantages and disadvantages and some of the liabilities and course of action. And what we're talking about is, you know, we're upstairs talking about the big gas pipeline and taxes and all those sorts of things. But, I mean, I hope that tomorrow we get gas out of Cook Inlet. But if that doesn't happen, we still need to get gas. If it has to come from North Slope or whatever the source is, we still have to get gas. And I hope it comes through Fairbanks if we get it off the North Slope. And I think, quite frankly, when I think of the railroad, we were talking about mining projects today, and there's a potential site for a concrete plant. And if they got natural gas, they could do that. And the railroad would have some business. So, you know, there are some things that benefit the railroad out of this. But to me, what we're talking about is a unity of effort that can, in fact, get some initiative, get some cooperation, and get some momentum that if we don't have to build it, that's okay. But we work through the course of action. We look at the economics, and we look at the challenges involved, but we have an organization that has a staffing oversight capability and has a bonding capability, has a right-of-way expertise, all those things that deal with moving things from one location to another. And, you know, we couldn't do much better if we were trying to tailor-make it. And I don't think we could do even that well. And today I just heard Donlin Creek. They said if we could get energy and power, we could go forward with this project, lots of it. And that's one of the things that in-state gas brings. And I just an editorial, I mean, I want us to have a big pipeline. And I think most Alaskans do. But I know we got to do in-state gas. When we have to do in-state gas, doesn't matter about big pipelines and if that gets us gas, but we will not wait 10 years for that to happen in my estimation. So I'm excited about the railroad being part of this for all the qualities they bring, and some of them are individual, some of them are leadership, and others just institutional capability. But if I could, General Gamble, when you're looking at the business of right-of-way, could you describe to us the sort of your planning and execution on right-of-ways and as it applies to railroads, would it be any different than it would be for a pipeline, or maybe it's existing right-of-ways that potentially you already have some experience with?
Sure, I can, Senator Huggins, talk about right-of-ways, but I don't want to trivialize the complexity of this, and I think that the point that I didn't make, Senator Wagner, was right up there second with the leadership and the support for the leadership to get the project done. There's got to be a business case, and I'm assuming there's a business case. You all probably know more about the business case than I do, and whether that makes, because there's got to be a market, there's got to be a producer. The two of them have to get together, and that all has to happen. We're talking about building the pipeline here, and so I'll confine my comments to that part of it. It's kind of interesting in a way, because the idea of right-of-way and the idea of maybe using existing right-of-way certainly has merit. I know one of the first things I did when Williams owned the refinery, the first time I ever visited them, they showed me a study they had done looking at where they would build a pipeline if they ever decided they didn't want to use rail cars to move the product out of the refinery at North Pole. And so a lot of work has been done. And you know, they were looking at trying to jump into our right-of-way wherever it was possible and use the advantage of dirt that had already been moved, because that's probably one of the single biggest expenses is moving the dirt and then moving it back again, whether it's rail or whether it's a pipeline. But the pipeline gets into things that rail doesn't get into and things that have to be understood and explored, and I'm not an expert in that at all, but I do know there's questions about can you put a high-pressure pipeline within so much distance of a rail line that carries passengers or hazardous materials? And if the answer is no, you can't, then we have to look at the 200-foot right-of-way of the railroad and determine whether or not that has to be expanded in places, if it has to sit outside that right-of-way. But, I mean, if you're digging a trench and filling it back in again, if you're building a rail or building a pipeline, and you're looking at the geographical line from point A to point B, pipelines can go up and over and around things that rails can't. The physics for the railroad is pretty much 3% grade at the max, and you want things to be as flat as possible, so you tend to go along the line between the edge of the mountain and the flats, and that's where the rail line pipeline can go right over the top. So there's some major differences between the two. But I think the idea that there are places where we could combine the two and maybe simplify permitting, and these are the things we've talked about in the past with people who have approached us, including NSTAR, several years ago, as a matter of fact.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And then one other thing, you know, by way of just talking about background and expertise, we talked about your mission being broad economic development. We've talked about bonding and financing authority. We've talked about rights of way a bit. One of the other things that I wanted you to talk to the committee a little bit about, we're getting close to time here, is the experience. One of the things that has been difficult in looking at an in-state gas pipeline has been the business of making it economic, bringing in the anchors, the industrial anchors and so forth that we need to make it work. There's residential anchors that we know about, but then at what kind of a tariff? And what intrigued me about the railroad as well is that being a public-private entity geared toward profit and other things, you're bringing buyers and sellers together. You're bringing private entities in. You're soliciting them in cases for transportation opportunities, business opportunities, and obviously responding to the ones that come to you. But certainly looking around at a bigger picture of Alaska's economic outlook and as it pertains to the railroad, reaching out to the private sector. So could you talk a little bit about that? Because that's one of the things that I really thought edged you into that level. When you think about a public entity out there or a governmental agency, and again, no disrespect to bureaucracy there, but there isn't that knowledge. We're not that good at knowing how the private sector thinks and how to bring those people together for those conversations. So I'd just like to hear a little bit about what you do at the railroad with respect to that.
Well, two thoughts come to mind. One of them gets back to my previous answer with regard to a business case. I mean, there needs to be a business case. When we set up, when we look at a potential new customer for rail, you've got a producer and you've got a buyer, and then we kind of link the two as a transportation organization. I mean, that's pretty much simply, that's what we do. But the construction of rail line, I mean, you're looking at us, as I assume, as being a project manager for a construction project, much like we would build the extension down to Delta Junction from Fairbanks. And we've got people that do that, except they don't build pipelines. We've got people who do marketing and go out and talk to customers, but they don't necessarily talk to the kinds of customer relationships that you would see in an open season between a producer on the North Slope and a buyer in either overseas or California or wherever. And when Governor Knowles, back in 2001, I believe it was, sort of dropped this bomb on us, I'll never forget it. I mean, I was in Washington and I got a phone call and said, you're going to be on TV in an hour and the governor's going to say, you guys are going to finance the pipeline. And back then it was $17 billion and we thought that was huge. And I was on TV in an hour, and I basically said, whatever the governor says, you know, we're ready to go. That's the last thing I gave the rah-rah speech.
Yeah.
But, I mean, really, the idea is, when we talked about it, that is so different than what the railroad's core business is, even though we're into real estate, for example, and that's a big part of where we make our profits and so on. That probably from a corporate point of view, and I remember this discussion among some of the board members because they were kind of reeling at this, and everybody realized very rapidly, we can't hurt the Alaska Railroad Corporation in an attempt to take something like this on. We've got to sort of wall off the good old boy Alaska Railroad Corporation that we all know and love around the shop there, and create something that can handle this new tasking. This is not part-time work. This is not amateur night work. This is serious, big-time stuff. And so the idea of spinning off some sort of a subsidiary or an LLC or something like that with a connection to the railroad probably makes as much sense today as we talk about this as it did back then among some board members who had a lot of business experience and seemed to think right off the bat that had to be the way to go forward. So I'll kind of leave it at that. I think that's probably still a reasonable approach.
Excellent point. And on in under Section 18-56086, you have the authority to create subsidiaries. That's already a power that you have. And it's under financing school construction, facilities of the University of Alaska, facilities in ports and harbors. And then just a question, has that been done yet? Have any subsidiaries been created?
Madam Chair, that's actually, I believe, Title 18, I think, is the HFC statute. So it's not that we're 40, Title 42.
So do you have any subsidiary power right now that sits on the books?
We, at this point, do not have. We have not created any subsidiary corporations.
Okay. Do you believe at the time when you were, cause, I mean, that may be something we need to amend in then. Do you believe that at the time you had those discussions with your board after the Knowles announcement, did the board believe that you had the authority to create a subsidiary without statutory?
This was informal discussion that never went very far because the initiative didn't go very far. Right away, it was determined that it wasn't going to take root, and so we never really got into that.
Okay. Well, we'd
have to put that out there as an item to discover further information about.
Excellent. So, yeah, that's a discussion for another point in time. We may want to replicate that Title 18 to give you that authority to look at that. Okay. Any further questions for the railroad guys at this time? Thank you so much. We look forward to our continuing dialogue. General, you had.
Madam Chairman, I appreciate the in your introduction, you know, you said that the. And I want to be sure that I don't appear as an advocate at this early stage because this is really complicated. There's a lot at stake. I have not had a discussion with my board other than to inform them. It's exciting to think that this is resource development on steroids, and that's great stuff. I mean, and we really like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, our position is when the governor signs a bill, we follow the law, and whatever that bill is going to say and when it says it, we'll be there.
Great. Excellent. Thank you so much. We appreciate all that you do in your current mission and your willingness to to consider this. And again, you know, it is a big task, but that's big ideas. I mean, that's what I think, that's the place we are in Alaska's history. That's what some of us feel, that, you know, mincing around and forming more committees and committees that will talk to other committees and deliver more reports really isn't going to get us where we need to be. And so we're looking for big, bold ideas to come into fruition, and thought of you right away. So as you said in your remarks, at a minimum, be flattered, and at a maximum, be honored to carry the flag right to the top of the hill there. So thank you very much. And with that, we're adjourned.